I have a bit of a cold.
Okay.
Can you tell?
Maybe.
I did squeeze stuff up my nose.
Ew.
No. How is that ooh? Nasal spray. Decongestion.
That's a squeezing. That's spraying, isn't it?
This one has a squeeze bottle. It wasn't a spray. It was a ew, squeeze.
I say again.
It wasn't very good. It went all down my throat.
Yeah, that's the ew. Ew.
Just thinking about it. Now that bitter. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a bi-monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. And welcome to Kirsten, back from Mongolia, apparently.
I told you I was going to Mongolia. I can't believe you thought that was a joke.
People say Mongolia to me, and I just assume that they're not telling me the truth.
Right. Where did you think I was going?
And I didn't think you were going anywhere. I thought anyone, you just talked about horses suddenly.
So I was just telling a very long, protracted three-month joke with no punchline?
Yeah.
Right.
How was Mongolia?
Mongolia was awesome, and I'm really glad I went, and I wish I hadn't come back.
And can you explain to the listeners what you did in Mongolia?
I rode a horse for 2 weeks.
And your horse was called?
I called my horse Nimble. They don't have names for horses over there.
And was Nimble a good horse?
He was a very nice horse, except when he was bitey.
Did you stone Nimble away in the carriage?
I wish I had. If I could have brought my horse home, I totally would have grabbed him. But he was owned by someone else, so.
The people in Mongolia are
No, actually, like a specific person, not just the organisation that we went through, so.
What, specific people loaning their horses out to tourists like you?
No, it was, well, she worked for the organisation, but this was her horse, but I think that's more like a company car over there.
Okay.
So, it was interesting.
This isn't The Adventures of Mongolia. It's or Kirsten's Adventures in Mongolia. It's an episode of The Writer and the Critic. But,
it
you
is.
Know, it's not often that I know people who, well, someone who's come back from Mongolia. So we're going to spend a good 2 or 3 hours discussing it.
We're not.
No?
Okay.
All right. Well, I've done nothing, just so you know. Since while you were in Mongolia, I was at home doing nothing.
Reading a lot of books, though.
Yeah, but, you know, why? You know, people do come up to me about this as if it's a shock. I mean, I'm a reader. Don't people read?
I think fewer and fewer people read.
Okay. Well, I'm reading about 9 to 10 books a month. For some people, that's a very small amount. I know people who read 350 books a year.
Well,
that's scary.
People who read 9 to 10 books a week sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I do get a little bit astounded when people go, oh my God, all these books you're reading. I'm thinking, well, yeah, okay.
Well, maybe it's not so much the reading, perhaps, as all the reviewing that you're doing.
Yeah. I'm doing a bit of that.
Finding
too.
The time, not only to read.
I don't
them,
know where
to
I seriously, them. I only find the time after everyone's asleep at home.
So when do you sleep?
You're assuming Jules goes to bed at like 11, but she goes to bed at 9.
Okay.
So there's actually a full evening fun planned by me on my own.
It's what great. Time does she get up?
About 5.
Oh, my God.
Because
Poor woman.
No, she does it to herself. I'm not making her. She gets up at 5.
I'm sorry.
Why'd you say poor woman? You make it.
How is. Oh, my goodness. That's so hilarious.
What?
Not all men, Ian.
What?
Like, you automatically took that as like me blaming you. It's just like, poor woman who has a job where she needs to get up at 5 a.m. every day.
She gets up at 5, A, because that's 8 hours sleep, and B, because she walks.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, but you automatically took that as, oh, it's not my fault.
Yes, I did.
It was nothing about you.
Okay.
I'm not saying you're setting an alarm for 5 a.m. and saying, get up, Jules, and do things. It's hilarious. It's not about you.
Mongolia is a far more interesting conversation than the time my wife gets up in the morning, whether it's my fault or not. So now that we've embarrassed me, nothing's changed. You've actually written down 2 talking points.
I have.
To open the podcast, neither of which you've actually introduced to me. So I'm hearing them for the first time now. Thanks for the preparation.
I only thought of them this morning when I was making up the running sheet.
Okay. So would you like to point to your talking?
Yeah. I don't think that's what that word means. So the first thing I wanted to mention is a project, actually, that Nicola Griffith is undertaking with the help of crowdsourced data, and I will put a link in the show notes if anyone is interested in helping out with crowdsourcing of the data, where she's looked at, or she is looking at, the books that have won awards over... She began with the last 15 years and she chose... half a dozen book-length fiction awards and fairly prestigious ones. So the Pulitzer, the Man Booker,
the National Book Award.
Hugo National Book Award. So
and the National Book Critics Circle
and
Award.
It's since been expanded out and wanting to go back in more time and in more detail. But the project is not – because there's a lot done with the Vita statistics and so on about the number of women who are published, the number of women who win awards, gender balances within
and
awards.
Reviewed, I believe, as well.
And reviewed. And it's become a topic – around award season, which is almost non-stop these days, looking at the fine-grained gender balance of awards, you know, and celebrating when, you know, 50-50 men and women are nominated for a shortlist and so on. What Nicola Griffith is doing, it's really interesting and it hadn't really occurred to me to even think about, was that she's looking at the books that win regardless of whether the author is a man or a woman.
Yep.
And looking at the protagonists in the book and what gender they are. And
okay.
She's found quite disturbingly, and it differs between award and award, and she does say that the more prestigious the award is, like the Pulitzer or the Man Booker, the more likely it is that the protagonists of the books that win are male, regardless of the gender of the author.
Really?
Really. And overwhelmingly, I think the Man Booker in the last 15 years, that she, her initial data search that she did, there were no female protagonists of any of the books that won.
That won.
And you, her argument is that it's not enough to talk about the gender or the ethnicity or sexuality of writers. It's not enough to look at that. It's also looking at the stories that we tell and the stories we decide are important.
The Flanagan was a male? Yep, definitely.
Okay, we don't need to. You can take
Eleanor Catton's book was all men.
Are we going to sit through the next 15 years so you can verify
actually,
what Nicola Griffith...
Well, actually, it's interesting because the Eleanor Catton Luminaries does have a female protagonist, but she's not... She did
differentiate between a book which only has a male protagonist, only a female, and who has both. So she's saying books which only have a female protagonist.
All right.
A book which is solely about a woman. None of them won the Man Booker in the last 15 years.
Okay, so there may have been books where a woman was a protagonist, but there was an accompanying man who was also a protagonist.
Yeah.
There have been none where a woman on her own is the protagonist.
Yeah, okay. And that's just the Man Booker. But since then, she and many other people who've come on board to help gather this data have done a further breaking down where instead of just that very rudimentary thing of, you know, male protagonist, female protagonist, indeterminate protagonist, or you know, dual.
Yep.
They've had a look at the numbers. And then so there might be three or four main characters in a book. So in Griffith's original count, that would have just been both genders.
Okay.
So having a look at the actual number of primary characters in a book and their gender, the numbers skew even more male. So you might have a book, for example, that has three main characters and two are male and one is female. And the point that she's making is that these are the stories that they've won awards, they've received a certain level of cultural prestige and recognition, and their stories about men.
Here's the thing. If you assume that the canon from 100 years from now is going to include winners of awards from 100 years previously, and the winners have mostly male protagonists or male point of view, then what does that say?
That says we're most interested in talking about men, and we don't find women very interesting at all.
That's one way of looking at it. It's a depressing way of looking at it.
It's a pretty accurate way of looking at it, I think. It's about the stories that we deem worthy of literature, worthy of awards, worthy of discussion and talking about. A corollary to what Griffith is doing is when you look at gender weighting in various genres and who the people are that are the focus of genres. So in romance, for example, the focus is very often on female characters. In action thrillers, the focus is very often on male characters, and no one has to say which genre is considered better than the other. So it's how we value our stories. It's how we deem a story to be important, whether it's about a man or a woman, whether it's about the concerns of someone who is male or the concerns of someone who is female.
That's for adult fiction. Does it skew the same for young adult?
She did look
That wasn't a Dorothy Dix because I have no idea.
No, she did look at the Newbery Award, which is an American. And again, I'm just going off her initial data, and there's much more there. I will link to it so people can go have a look and maybe help if you have time. And in the Newbery Award, she said it was really interesting. I'll just quote from one of her articles. Women wrote wholly from girls' perspectives 5 times and men wrote so 3 times. So girls are interesting and girls count. However, women don't. So, okay, yes, so there are more.
It does
more,
skew differently, okay.
It's still weighted to male characters, but the balance is a lot closer. Whereas, yeah, basically adult women, older women, middle-aged women, elderly women, their stories are not worth telling. And if they are told, they're certainly not worth considering for an award.
Is there any point in comparing those results to what was actually nominated? Because these are the winners.
Yeah, I think she's looking into that. I think as I said, this was her initial speculation that it had just kind of occurred to her and she went looking, and now she has broadened the project to a more fine-grained approach, and she's enlisting, as I said, it's a crowdsourced data project, and I think she has like Google Docs and everything going. So if people want to contribute, I mean, it's a big project.
And we never saw Nicola Griffith again.
Exactly. She's got the sequel to Hilda, right? Damn it. Help her do this so she can get back to it. But yeah, it's not something I'd ever consciously thought of in that way. Even though we talk all the time about having female stories and stories that concern women, I hadn't ever mapped that to thinking about what kind of books win awards.
I'm going to do the 101 thing. Kirsten, the judges don't pick the book with the most female protagonist. They pick the best book.
Aren't we just passed the 101 thing?
No, because that you'll get that, though. I don't know what sort of response, because I actually didn't know this had been written, and I only looked now. It was done in May, so it's been out for 3 months now.
Yeah.
And it did not hit my radar at all, so I apologise.
It just get picked up by a couple of online media outlets that she was doing.
But that's always the first comment. Yeah. When someone does an IO9 or does a repeat of this, first thing is, no judge is picking based on protagonists. They're picking based on quality.
Gender. I'm colorblind.
So in this, because it's about a winner.
Mm.
So the judge, they're only picking based on quality. They're not flicking through and going, was it good? And did it have a female?
Sure. And this.
That's my comment voice person. Did you notice?
So we can distinguish you from actual Ian.
That's it. This is comment voice person. Yes.
Thank you. But that's exactly the point of this type of data. That is exactly the point. Unless you are willing to concede that somehow, miraculously, only stories written about men are worthy, like objectively worthy of being awarded some of the most prestigious literary prizes we have, then you have to question the implicit bias in judges, reviewers, readers, writers. You know, you can say, I mean, it's a truism, of course. The judges picked the book they thought were the best book. But why did they think it was the best book? What factors, conscious, unconscious, is going into
One will ever say, ever, I thought this was the best book because a bloke was the point of view character.
Of course they won't. Of course they will never say that.
It's because I had an emotional engagement with it.
Why did they have emotional engagement? Why do they have an emotional engagement over a book about a man more than a book about a woman?
That's...
You know, all of these things factor into it, and it's...
No one wants to dig into those biases and prejudices. No one does. I mean, obviously Nicola Griffith is doing this, but when you ask that question just then, no one really wants to explore that in any great depth.
Of course no one does. It's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to recognise that all of us have these unconscious biases within us. You know, to use a very simplistic example, because people often say, oh, well, you know, it's like your favourite flavour of ice cream. There's nothing. But more and more research now is showing that actually your flavour palette and flavours that you like, they're influenced by your environment, by the foods that your mother eats when you're in utero and a whole bunch of stuff. Things like all of these biases, whether they're social or cultural or environmental or whatever they are, they're locked within us. We're not some pristine organism that somehow miraculously can make these objective decisions about things.
You know what would be interesting? If as a comparison, a point of comparison, if she plonked in the Bailey Prize or Orange Prize or whatever the hell it's called. It's the Bailey Prize.
So. And as I said, I think she probably has, because this was...
Well, the Bailey Prize being an award that's specifically given to a female writer, as a contrast.
What I'm saying, the thing I printed out and showed you was only the initial post that she did, and the project has expanded out to include as many awards as they can, and to go back beyond 15 years, and to, it's become expansive. This was her initial, I wonder what the books are about. I'm just going to go have a quick look at 6 awards over 15 years type thing. But the data that they're finding is bearing this out. It's bearing out the cultural bias we have about stories about men. And how worthy they are.
As more of these sorts of projects are done, and as the internet becomes more and more vicious, there's the prevailing view of, can we stop doing these sorts of studies now because who cares?
Well, I think the sentence you just said before that shows a hell of a lot of people care. If people didn't care, people wouldn't be being vicious about it. Like, honestly, it's like if you don't care, if it doesn't bother you one way or the other, why say anything at all? Obviously, it bothers you. Obviously, the idea that of unconscious bias working on a cultural level systemically bothers you. It obviously bothers you, you wouldn't.
This is, I swear, I'm not speaking as me, but it's seen as just another
thing.
Put the
voice on, Ian.
Yeah, it's rude as another thing to feel guilty about when I'm reading. I can't read for pleasure anymore. I can't, because I've got to feel guilty about who wrote the book, who published the book, who are the protagonists in the book, what sort of impression is this leaving on my subconscious, how is it going to be seen as in terms of legacy, and this, you know, where's the biases, where are the prejudices, what happened to... Again, I'm speaking as the comment man here. Where is the just the basic tenet of enjoying prose for what it is?
You can do that. If that's how you read, do that. Like, what's stopping you?
People feel threatened.
Why?
Because they don't want to investigate these unconscious bias.
Okay, then don't. Read how you're reading.
Because people assume that when you say unconscious bias, what you're actually saying is that everyone's a racist. Or in this case, everyone's a sexist or a misogynist. The judges of these awards over the last 50 years are just widespread misogynism, whatever the word is. That's what it is. It's just a whole bunch of men judges and some women judges being misogynistic towards literary prizes.
No, it's pointing to cultural bias. Is what it's doing. What you say is true. People do see these things and they feel that they themselves, if they like a book which someone points out has a problem or a series of books or a pattern, if they like, then they feel that, they should feel guilty and that they're a racist or a misogynist or whatever it is. And they may well be.
And often if they comment on it, they actually sound like one. Yeah,
actively. But... more often, this is how a bias works. It's not something you go out and declare. It's something that...
accretes over time.
Exactly. It's something that, you are exposed to that shapes you in your culture. We all have it.
You know what?
Every single one of us. So anyway, so that was that. I think.
Oh,
that
sorry,
project,
sorry, I didn't let you finish.
I think that project is worth drawing attention to.
Yes, it is.
And as I said, this is not something that... you can read and get angry about and upset about, and that's it. You can help. You can help with the data. You can help provide the numbers and the information that's needed to paint this more detailed picture.
In terms of helping with the data, is it clear what they've got, what they don't have?
So I haven't looked at the Google Docs myself, but as I understand it, Griffith has set up a public a semi. Because obviously you don't want trolls getting into your data. But if you email her and you volunteer to help and blah, 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 then you get access to everything. Okay, and you can go and you can correct someone else's. If someone else has listed a book as blah, 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 you can say, no, actually I think. So there's, it's a self-correcting mechanism in a way as well as a data source mechanism.
Okay, cool. All right, that's good.
And it's not going to be absolutely perfect, but it's not going to be absolutely wrong either. So I think it's well worth investigating and, if you have the time, helping out with. Because, we all do love to have evidence to point to when people go, oh, well, there's no bias. It's like, really? And also, can I point out the bias is a value-neutral term. Bias is a descriptor. It's pointing out a statement of fact that there is a preponderance of weight towards one aspect of something you were looking at as opposed to another aspect. That's all it is. And you it's irrefutable. You cannot refute bias if it has been properly collated and presented.
I agree.
You can talk about the reason behind it and so on, and then you get into value judgments. But bias itself is just a descriptor, and people should not get so hung up about it when people talk about bias in awards, because there demonstrably is bias in awards. Now, why that is, that's a whole other debate. But first, it's good to have the data.
Okay.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about, which I just read, I also see that it was published back in April, but I only read it last week. I think it came around Facebook. But it was an article on Jezebel by Catherine Nichols, who wrote about submitting her unpublished manuscript to agents under a male pseudonym.
Yes, I have a vague memory of this.
You have a vague memory.
Oh, there's just so much on the internet.
I know. You have to filter. And she basically she'd sent it out under her own name.
Yep.
About 25 times, she said. She got one request to look at the full manuscript. A lot of the responses she got back were talking about her writing being beautiful and lyrical and so on, but her female character being maybe not feisty enough or something like that. And she got quite frustrated and was thinking about the Vita statistics about the number of authors who get written about and reviewed and published according to gender lines. And she just, as kind of an experiment, made up a Google account, a Google email account under a fake name. She calls him George, but that wasn't the name she used, and started sending out the exact same manuscript with the same cover letter, just signed George Liar, I think she said the pseudonym was. And she, the response time was much shorter, even immediate. She got 17 out of 25 manuscript requests out of the submissions.
Can I just stop you there?
Yep.
This is the same manuscript. Is she sending it to the same place as she sent as a woman?
I don't know. She didn't. That was not clear from the article she wrote.
Because it could be a whole bunch of really stupid people who don't remember.
Sure.
It's the first thing that pops into my head. Anyway, keep going. Sorry, I derailed you.
But again, the statistical likelihood of, let's say there were 50 agencies that were completely different and she sent half under her name Catherine and half under her name George, the statistical likelihood that she just happened to send all of George's to the ones who, regardless of gender, wanted to see the manuscript and hers to only one of them, that's a little beyond the point.
No, that's a fair point.
The sentence I really loved was in this article was that talking about the data and how many manuscript requests she got as George as opposed to Catherine, he's 8.5 times better than me at writing the same book.
It's
such a beautiful way to put it. It's like it's the same book and yet under a male name. And George's responses that he got, even with rejections, were quite positive. He had a lot of detailed rejections. Words were used like it was exciting and clever and well-constructed, but rather than, you know, lyrical writing and beautiful prose. And she's talking about how things can play into this. Like, for example, obviously it's easy to sell a book by a man. So agents might already be more amenable to reading a manuscript by a man than by a woman. Again, that doesn't mean it's a good thing or that it's men's books are better or anything like that, but that's a marketing thing that factors into it. She said a lot of women's manuscripts, especially by unpublished authors, are kind of put in the pigeonhole psychologically as women's fiction, and her manuscript wasn't. So the agent might be going, well, this is going to be hard to sell because it's not women's fiction, whatever that vague term means. So she's pointing out all these things that could have factored into why George got so many more requests than she did. But again, all these things are not good. It's not good to make these decisions based on the fact that you think it's better to sell a man's book than a woman's book, or it's better if a woman only writes women's fiction than something else.
Did any of the agents go with George?
She does not say whether George got offered any, because she the whole time she was saying she just felt very uncomfortable with the whole process and felt she was being deceitful, where I think it's just like, why the fuck not? And the other point that she made was really interesting because she related a discussion. I'll just read this verbatim, talking about how unconscious bias being difficult to overcome, and how maybe agents were just subconsciously friendlier to George. She said, once I met an agent face-to-face and we discussed the first 20 pages of the novel, he said it was good, but it was so ambitious he doubted that I would be able to pull off the whole book at that level. So he would have given it a form rejection if it had come through the mail. The difference could be, again talking about agent subconscious bias, could be in the gut assessment of how likely a George is to pull off something ambitious opposed to a Catherine. And she's saying, like, how many women writers and writers of colour and writers who inhabit a different space to the mainstream get pushed away, get closed down, get ushered back towards a more conservative approach because they're not told that their manuscript is bold and exciting and, yes, keep working and we'd like to see more. There was another line that I loved. It was, to some degree, I was being conditioned like a lab animal against ambition. My book was getting at least a few of those rejections because it was big, not because it was bad. George, I imagine, would have been getting his clevers all along and would be writing something enormous now. And it's kind of, it's like all of this bundles into, again, the types of stories we tell, the types of writers we read, the expectations we have about the stories we read and who is telling them. And, it's depressing as hell. I was so depressed for like a week after I read this. And it links back to what Nicola Griffith was talking about, is that this is not – these issues are not something you address at the level of who gets nominated for awards and who gets reviewed. They go back much deeper than that. They go back to the types of books people think they can and should write, that they're capable of writing, the type of books that agents and publishers think people are capable of writing or should write. So there are much deeper systemic issues.
Why did we start the podcast? That is... awful. Just the idea that I don't think you can pull this off, little girl. I don't think that's not. No, I never said little girl. I wasn't being. It wasn't about her sex. I didn't genuinely think she had the chops.
Yeah.
You know, really, you didn't genuinely think the first 20 pages isn't enough evidence to. No, well, I don't think she has the chops. Fuck off.
But again, this is like, and that's not like it's really it's difficult, if not impossible, to tease out what is cultural inculcated bias.
Yeah, I understand.
And I've, not something that's even...
Because they'll say, I've been in the industry for 40 years and I've seen proposals like this in the past, and I could tell you that they start well but they fall apart, and I didn't want to see author X, gender aside, having to go down the same bolt hole.
Yeah, and I mean, I read an article just a few days ago that someone wrote about non-white characters on book covers.
Yep.
And among the comments, there was this screed from a person who decided to take it upon himself to talk about how people of colour don't read science fiction and fantasy.
Yes, I saw the same thing. This was on SF Single.
Because, because, you know, culturally they, you know, those kinds of people don't think about those kinds of
things.
Was
this the guy who said, I'm at work.
At work, the black people I know don't read it, therefore.
Don't read it. And uninterested in what I'm reading.
And uninterested what I... And it's just, for a start, you think maybe they just don't want to talk to you because you don't sound very nice. But, I mean, this is the problem. And this guy would not.
Who the fuck sits there on a keyboard typing that and not realize, self-aware enough to realize
what he's talking? This guy does not think he's racist. He's making what he thinks are objective observances. And if in his mind, people who aren't white don't read science fiction and fantasy, then why would you put them on the covers? Because it's marketing, right? It's marketing.
Yeah, I get that. But a vaguely intelligent person would know that the sample size of the five people of colour in your office, who probably think you smell anyway, isn't big enough to determine what should be on a cover or not.
Sure. I know, but...
But you put it on the fucking comment of an... And, you know, he's not a troll.
No, he was not a troll.
You know,
it was way too long to be a troll comment.
And had grammar, and he can spell. I mean, it's so.
So any ignorant people are racist.
No, it's not.
See,
what I'm
that's a bias. Oh. No, I'm just point like it's everywhere. This stuff is everywhere. Like it's impossible.
It's pervasive. I get it.
It's pervasive, and it is everywhere.
And yet you're told.
And pointing to it
stop
shouldn't
being politically correct.
Pointing to it shouldn't be a problem.
Like you did with
you just pointed to it. It's like you stepped in dog poo.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you walk around all the time with dog poo. I'm not saying you're the type of aficionado of dog feces, and that's kind of weird. If there are aficionados of dog feces out there, it is a little weird, but more power to you. I'm just pointing out that on this one occasion, there's some dog poo on your shoe and you might want to rub that off on the grass before you come inside. I'm not making a moral judgment about you. I'm not, you know, it's, this is the kind of thing. It's like you stepped in something, wipe it off and, you know, don't drag it on my carpet. And I'm sure I've done it myself many times. Because you do, your immediate reaction is, oh, this thing that I like or this thing that I didn't notice. Oh no, what's wrong with me that I like this thing which now that you've pointed out I see is not that great. And we need to acknowledge that we're steeped in all this stuff for a start, that there is ways to enjoy stuff which other people don't. And that it's not necessarily this finite and absolute value judgment on your own character.
Yep.
You know, and don't freaking double down on it and come back and talk about being gender blind and colour blind and unbiased as though you're the one human being ever in the history of the fucking world who has no implicit
nothing
bias.
Nothing seems to change. And we will talk about this for decades to come.
Sure.
I think it changes
incrementally and slowly. It absolutely changes. It definitely does. But it's slow. It's very slow. And it's multi-generational.
Okay.
Look, this article written about sending out my novel under a male name and how depressing that was, maybe a few agents or publishers will read that and go, you know what? Yeah, maybe I'll look at the next manuscript that comes across my desk with a female name with a slightly more open mind. Like, yeah. It's important to talk about this stuff. It's not whinging.
I'm not saying
you are, but you know, it is important to talk. It is important to continue the conversation always.
Even if you're just repeating the same thing you've said 100 times.
Sure, because you will not be repeating it to the same people.
Ah, thank you. Well said. Thank you. That's good. No, great. I like that.
Some of the same people, but you know, hopefully new people along the way.
The Godless by Ben Peake.
Godless. That's a brutal segue. That is brutal.
And that's all we have to say on The Godless by Ben Peake. And
yes, I chose The Godless. I won't say recommend because I hadn't read it first. It was off my to-be-read pile, and it's a book I dearly wanted to read.
Isn't it nice we've both got the exact same book?
We
and
oh, you mean edition?
Yes.
No, yes.
We read the same book.
I know, that's like, what did you read? Did you read The Godless by, you know, Whitney blah, blah, blah?
Well, that's an interesting name, Whitney blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But also, this is the first book this year I've read in hard copy.
Oh, wow.
It's taken
so how? Like, why? Why do you have it in hard copy?
I bought it. It's
no, but why in hard copy and not?
No. I bought it a few months ago.
Yeah.
Intending to read it at some point in the distant future. I still do buy actual physical books. Okay. And I bought this one. But the point I'm making is that until August the 10th, I had not read a single physical copy book.
And that's a big book. How'd you go? That's a lot heavier than a Kindle.
I realised that my wrists have deteriorated over the last few years and that, seriously, I needed a stand or something. But no, it was all right. No, it was all good. And that I'd never want to read another physical book this year. No, that's not true either. But I just thought I'd mention that. Anyway, yes.
That's interesting. I'm still reading a lot of physical books. A lot of physical books. And it's like sometimes I wish they were digital because then you could do a search about that phrase or that word that
you've
you
got no idea how easy it is, how much easier it is to review because of ebooks.
Like, and you can highlight stuff. What was that sentence where she said something about
yes,
blah, blah, blah?
Correct. And I
highlights as you go.
I use Marvin. That's my ebook. I know this is not, I can't believe we're talking about this, but I use Marvin. It allows me to highlight, but also leave little
notes. Marvin?
Marvin is an ebook app.
It's thought you had a Kindle.
No, I don't. I've got an iPad.
Oh, okay.
So I use Marvin.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Okay. Is that
now they all allow you to highlight and do all that?
Is it for iPad Apple products only, or is
no? It's I think pretty sure
Android.
It's on the Android. I'm
okay.
Pretty sure it's on the Android. It's really good. It allows you to highlight. Da da da. I've said that now 6 times. Mm. They all allow you to highlight and do notes. Well, this one though, it allows you to export them into another document, so you can actually see a lot of the others don't. Like Kindle, okay. It's very hard to get the note off your actual Kindle onto something else.
Yeah.
This just lets you to Just with that noise, it makes a noise.
So you can dump your notes.
Correct. It's extremely valuable when I'm looking for quotes for one of my reviews.
To Marvin. Maybe they should sponsor our podcast.
Yeah, I'll give them a call.
Give us money. Well, next episode, we tell you how rubbish you are.
Should we discuss the gods?
Yes, we should get back to the gods. Okay.
Just wanted to make sure we wanted to discuss it. Okay.
Which is a brick. It is a brick. It's
562 pages.
Wow, you know that by heart.
Yes. Yes, I do.
You counted every one of those pages as you turned, didn't you? It's like, yes, another.
Because that's the other thing ebooks don't have, page numbers.
No, but they got the percentage bar. So.
Correct. And that's what I'm used to, the percentage bar.
Percentage bar.
The physical copy doesn't have a percentage bar. I had to work it out mathematically in my head as I was reading.
You had to, and as yes, you were, I did that. As you were holding the book, you had to see how much you had left.
I was working out in my head.
You were not.
I swear I was working out where I was percentage-wise in the book because I'm so used to it. I also like doing that sort of stuff. It's a little anal retentive thing of mine.
Well, you used to play like that cricket game with not even any graphics. So anyway,
because that's stats. I like stats. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
You should join Nicola Griffith's project if you like stats.
So you suggested this book.
I did.
It has two maps. Well, it has a drawing of a city and a map.
Yes, it does. But that's not why I suggested it. I'll just point that out. Because it seemed an odd way to begin. We're going to look at every page and do a page by page. And then there's a table of contents page.
And that still wasn't the reason why.
Actually, no, there's no table of contents. No, there's a prologue.
There is a prologue. So this was part of your Australian author's better representation on the podcast.
Yes. Gambit. Yes, it is. It is. It is. And I also bought this book not long after it came out, and it's just been sitting there because it's not a PhD book.
So the guilt set in.
So I better make it some other kind of homework book. So I chose it for the podcast. I don't read for pleasure anymore. That's just gone. It's all homework now in one form or another. It's just homework. Anyway.
Okay. So
The Godless is the first book in the children trilogy. Curiously, in a lot of the reviews I've since read, and in fact, it even got nominated for the Morningstar.
The Gemmell Awards.
Which is the debut novel. But it's not Ben Peake's debut novel. So I don't – like everyone's talking about it as a debut, but he published Black Sheep back in 2008, 7, 6, something like that, late 2000s. So I don't understand unless that was in an alternate world and somehow I came into this world and there's no Black Sheep.
Well, Black Sheep did have its own problems. Not the book itself, but the
yeah, but it was a novel. It was a novel.
But it was published. It did come out. You could still buy it.
Yeah, that was his debut novel. So yeah. I don't know why. I mean, certainly.
You don't call 26 Lies and One Truth and his debut novel?
Yeah, I mean, you could, but that's a really eccentric, whether you call that a novel or not.
Okay.
I don't know. But that's debatable, but certainly
Black Sheep was a novel.
Standard length.
It's his debut fantasy novel because Black Sheep is science fiction.
But do we do that?
No.
I mean,
no, we do not do that.
If someone, say, writes 10 really excellent crime novels and then they write a fantasy novel, do they get nominated for a Morningstar?
But we don't want to be telling the Gemmell Awards that they got it wrong. I think that would be wrong.
It's very weird. Anyway, so it's the Ben Peake's debut fantasy novel. I'd actually, in my head, had it slightly wrong because I think when I chose this book, I said to you, because you said, have you read it? And I said, no, but I've read other stories in that world and I really like them. I'd gotten mixed up with his Red Sun stories and that world, and it's not that world. It feels like they almost could be in the same kind of a world, but they have a familial link, I guess.
Okay.
That's what it feels like.
The fact that they're written by the same person is a link as well.
Thank you, Captain Obvious. I hadn't actually read anything in this world. But you know what? It's so funny. And I'm going to just say this up front, that I'm not in love with this book. And it is not the book's fault. It's just so totally me because I'm reading it. And, like, intellectually I'm really enjoying the book and there's a lot of great things about it that I really, really liked. And I just wasn't feeling this connection that I really wanted to feel, that I definitely did feel, and we'll get to it, with The Book of the Unnamed Midwife that I finished just like a week before I started this one. And I really think that part of that is, for me, I just have to admit, I'm really not a great big fantasy reader. I'm just not. and I need to stop trying to be.
What is it exactly about fantasy? Because I've read a shitload of fantasy in the last 3 months.
Yeah.
Which I'm going to talk about in a second in relation
to
this
book.
Well,
I've read a lot more fantasy in the years we've been doing this podcast than I did for the 10 or 20 years beforehand. I used to read a lot of fantasy.
Is it the affected writing style? Because there isn't a certain effect.
No, I think like his writing style, I think, was really suited to the book. And it's not that. I think it's
no, but I'm just saying generally, because a lot of fantasy novels do have that affected faux medieval type,
and that I hate
writing. So this,
but I don't think. But Peake isn't doing that. I think the style in his book. I mean, it's there's a certain elevation to the prose.
Yep.
It's not contemporary 21st century prose.
No, clearly not. Yep.
But it's not twee oldie worldy.
No, it's not
faux medievalish prose either. I think it's just a very clear, very strong voice, and it's an omniscient narrator too. And I think that voice works really, really well throughout the whole book, which is one of its strengths, because in terms of narrative presentation, it's very fractured. So having that strong voice is one of the strengths of the book, because that's what brings you through the book, even though it's, you know, there's a lot of non-linear directions, there's a lot of very sudden introductions to
but it's funny you should say that, because
so
this is probably one of the more focused fantasy novels I've read this year.
Yeah.
I mean, this has only three point of view characters.
Yeah. Oh no, it's very focused. But what I'm saying is, it is it's not a straight linear presentation.
And, no. But even
and it's not, you know, chapter for this person, chapter for this person. Everything, it's almost it's not a mosaic novel. And I'm not saying that, but mosaic is the term I kind of want to use, because it feels like it's like there's an expressionism about this book. There's lots of bits that are just sort of put there, but they're unified by, to some extent, by the voice of the book.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, okay.
So he's not, what I'm saying is, he's not trying to give IA and Zaphir and Berulian their own unique style of writing or their own unique voice to differentiate them. The book itself has its voice, and that's really nice, and I think that's one of the solid features of it.
So what is it then?
I think because where the godless and where it's not just the godless, it's this genre is it sits too far on the towards the mythic end of the spectrum for me. And I kind of solidified these thoughts in the last week. I re-listened to a talk that Kidge Johnson gave. It was one of the annual Tolkien lectures.
Yep, okay.
I'll try to dig up the link for that. I just had the file on my computer, so I'll see how I go. And she was talking about the, you know, narrative on at one end, the mimetic end, so narrative which tries to be completely realistic, grounded in the real world, does nothing that's not real, which in its purest form is impossible because you're reading a book, and the mythic at the other end, which is, again, in its purest form is an impossibility. But this is your spectrum, and, and where you sit a narrative along that spectrum will depend on its subject matter, its tone, often its setting, a whole bunch of stuff. And then you have this overarching sort of umbrella thing of the metafictional, which is a bit wink-winky and can still be on the spectrum, but it also sits kind of above it because it knows it's on the spectrum and is pointing to where it is around it. And I think the more, for me, the more a work of fiction slides towards the mythic, the less engaged I am on anything but a purely intellectual level. Whereas if it's more to the mimetic, not too far, because then I get a bit bored. I want there to be a little bit of non-mimesis in my fiction, ideally. Not all the time, but ideally. The more engaged I am, because I think the closer that it feels to me, to my life experience, to the world I know. Whereas, and again, this is like, I'm not saying The Godless is a bad book or that the genre, the fantasy genre at large is a bad genre. It's just that for me, I don't connect to it as well because it's a very intellectual exercise. This world is,
I'm only half buying this.
You know, I'm not trying to convince you that this is an attitude that you should take. I'm just saying for me, I think this is where it's coming from.
Yeah, but I'll tell you why I'm only half buying it. There's got to be something more than just the fact that there's magic in this world and there's gods and most fantasy that's stopping you from engaging fully with whatever it is, the characters or the setting. It's got to be more to it than just that. I think there are conventions within fantasy that I have issues with that Peak doesn't entirely get around.
Yeah.
Which I'll talk a bit
and that's
about.
Part. I mean, conventions are a big part of how a book is formed and where it sits genre-wise and so on. But, I don't know. I haven't yet really fully articulated even to myself. No, but even to myself, it's something I'm still thinking about.
Okay.
Because there have been fantasy books I remember really liking, but just not recently.
Well, do you want to provide some detail behind the mythicness of this particular fantasy novel in terms of its setting and plot?
Well, gods are real.
Well.
Shit, you're right over there straight away. I mean, you can't escape that.
Well, they're real, but also dead.
Yeah, but they're real.
Yes.
And they're dying. They're not.
Well, no, we only find out as the book progresses.
Yeah, but they're dying.
We're told that 15,000 years ago, there was a war between the 78 gods.
Yeah, divine war. And they all killed each other.
And they all died.
Yeah.
Then we're told later on that actually they're not dead. They're dying. They're just lingering. They're a bit radioactive as well. In their death throes, they've let out their sort of the two things
they've formed the world.
Yes, and they've anchored the elements and other things. I mean, I do love the fact that the sun was one thing, and then when they died, the sun got split into three because again they had anchored. Well, one of the gods had anchored the sun as a single entity, which I love. I think that's just a beautiful idea. And as a result of them now dying, not dead. The magic, for use of a better term, is seeping out like a radiation.
Well, divine energy, I guess.
Yes, yeah. and some people get swamped with it and are therefore seen as cursed because they've got powers.
Mm.
So it's how the magic users in this world are born.
And there's a higher level of people who see themselves as on their way
gods,
to evolving.
To godhood.
To be gods.
Correct.
Yeah. And I think, I think the reason I was talking about, mimetic fiction versus mythic fiction. It's like I can almost pinpoint where I disconnected from the book.
Okay.
And again,
this is good.
Not the book's fault.
No, stop saying that. Where did you disconnect?
No, but I think that's important because, as you get older, you realize that what you like and what you don't like is not an objective opinion necessarily. Because when it first started, and he does a very, what I think is a very elegant, a very expedient thing in that he does a lot of his historical world building, so what happened way back when, through excerpts of a book called The Godless, that preface each part. And it's written by, at the beginning, it seems to be written by a character called Kian, who we later find out is one of the characters in the book. In a previous, not incarnation, but...
He's a long-lived character and he's changed his name.
Yeah, and that's it. But we don't find out that this book,
correct.
The Godless, is written by this character until maybe halfway through.
Yeah, about that,
And so, you've got this historical book talking about history and what happened back when the gods died, and the book opens, and I'm just going to read the prologue, actually. The spine of Gur had been made from stone by hand. It ran across the mountains of Morea, along its peaks and valleys, an uninterrupted length that followed the vertebrae of the dead god Gur, who lay beneath the mountains. The being who had once been known as the Warden of the Elements had been a giant whose head had cleared the clouds, a figure that had been stationary until the final decades of his long life. His dark, scarred hands had held long spike chains with collars that upon his fall tore apart the land and created the crevasse that his long body would lie in. For hundreds of years after, his voice was heard in the rustle of leaves around him, in the storms above, in the floods of rivers, and the crackle of fire that began by lightning. It continued long after Gur had finished building the mountain range around himself, a tomb wormed with mineral-rich excesses to hide his ravaged body, but died long before the last brick of the spine had been laid. In the 11,000 years since the final stone had been placed, only the roots of ancient trees had caused the spine to alter its shape. Large roots lifting stone or hollowing earth beneath, though none had broken its flow, and it now stood, old and weathered, its construction as subject to fiction as the god beneath it, the stone patterned green by mould and moss when covered and bleached by the sun's exposure where the old thick canopy fell away. And it's a beautiful passage, and it leaves you with an ambiguity because this could be a creation myth. This could be there's a mountain range. Oh yes, it's the spine of the dead god. And then you can read those excerpts from Kian's manuscript with a certain amount of ambiguity. This is a guy telling stories, and it's not until maybe you're about a quarter of the way through the book that it really nails down that no, the gods are real, and Ger is in fact there is the corpse of a giant dead god underneath this mountain.
Yep.
And that's almost precisely at the point where I went, huh, all right. And I kind of disengaged, and it was weird. It was weird. It was not a conscious disengagement. It was not like, oh, well, I don't really want to read about God, so never mind. It was just, in retrospect, I felt at that point I drew back a little, because that book suddenly just shot so far along the mythic arm.
Yeah, but it's the opposite for me. That's when I find it more fascinating.
Yeah, because I thought if I'm going to read a book, I don't read the blurbs. Yeah, I don't read around the books. And I thought it was beginning as a really interesting look at belief and mythology and how these things come about and how that's integrated into culture. But once the gods are real, then it's
and it actually isn't.
And also I remember reading on Ben Peake's blog as he was writing The Godless, and I think I definitely got the impression further on that it was a book that was going to be. And in fact, I read an interview just recently where he was saying he set out to write an atheist book, a book about, you know, morality without gods, which is what this book kind of does, but underpinned by the idea that gods are real, even if they're now dead, but they were real.
Yeah, but this is not a book about faith. This is a book about moving on.
Faith is a part of. I think there is a discussion of faith, of what you do, because I mean, I wonder.
It depends how you define faith.
Well, I do wonder at the def. Well, that's it. There is no faith if the gods are real, right? Correct. Don't have to have faith. You can dig under the mountain, and there are the gods.
I wasn't surprised by a lack of conversation necessarily about faith itself.
Well, not faith so much, as religion.
It's
a religious cult that lays siege to the city,
and who is trying to
resurrect the gods,
and who happened to be correct,
exactly.
But but there's none of those discussions about belief and faith in terms of a supernatural being that you can't see.
Well, no, because you can see
the gods
them.
That can
like
be
you,
seen.
You can dig under the mountain.
It felt more like a conversation about. The gods died, that era and epoch is over, and some of us just want to move on.
Yeah.
That's what Godless felt like. Yeah. We just want a bit like today, from an atheist point of view, even if there were gods or a god, he's sort of not relevant anymore. We've moved on.
Which is the kind of the tone of the book, which is a really interesting – and it's an interesting conversation to have, but I think for me it just felt – not undermined is the wrong word. That discussion felt – hampered or hemmed in by the fact that you keep going back to this is not a world where God may or may not have existed, where the creationists may or may not have been mythology. It's all real.
I can't agree with you.
And I'm not
sure. I get what you're saying, but I can't agree because
the
ambiguity didn't bother me, or lack thereof did not bother me.
Yeah. It's just that
it's when you withdrew. I get that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's not that it bothered me. It's just that's when it stopped being
a sort of book you would like.
Yeah, the sort of book I would really engage with.
You like how I finish your sentences?
It's very good. Well, I'm having trouble today, so that's quite welcome just today.
Okay.
So it became this other book. And again, it wasn't a conscious thing. It wasn't something that I just sat back and went, oh, well, that's that then. But looking back, it's like, yeah, that's when I drew back a little. Because and still appreciate, like it was still like – When I say drew back, it's not that I started hating the book or was bored or something, but my engagement with it was just purely intellectual.
Okay. Well, can I jump in? Not that I haven't been listening to you, because I have been.
Yes.
But I just wanted to say that I've been reading, as I said before, a shitload of fantasy.
Yeah.
And what this book does that's different to quite a few of the books, award-nominated books I've read this year, is that it's not a book about power plays specifically for a throne or a king. So a couple of the books I've read this year have been about either the king dying and the new king, usually a young person who's not
A reluctant person.
Yes, yes. A reluctant king having to find a way around it. And that's, you know, a book like The Goblin Emperor, to an extent, Half a King, to extent The Emperor's Blades by Brian Staveley. They're all about, but they're also behind all that, even because the plots aren't identical, behind that there's the power play and the political machinations that go in that. There's political machinations in this book, but this is not about, you know, people, the Lyrans, I think they're called, are not attacking this city because they're trying to take the throne. It's because they're trying to revive a god. And that, in of itself, just there makes this different to 85% of the fantasy novels I've read this year. I mean, even Cameron Hurley's novel, this first book in her series, even that one, while it's not specifically about, it is. It's also about political machinations. She does it differently, but it's also about that power play, kingdoms rising and falling. This is very much not that. Tick. That's tick number one. Tick. Because it's different.
I did. It's
refreshingly different.
I appreciated that. I appreciated that it also wasn't a book about it was, you know, there was war in the book. It wasn't a book about war. No. And in fact, the third point of view character, Berulian, he's not a great, you know, he is a big man, but he's not like a soldier who goes out on the front line. He's a saboteur. He's a mercenary, but he's a mercenary in the saboteur.
Correct. And we do get, well, I mean, there is battle. I mean, and
there is, but it's not like
Peake doesn't escape that particular convention.
Well, there's a siege of the
honest, that's probably the stuff that interests me the least. The whole siege stuff, the whole collapsing of parts of the city to survive the siege. That just the whole army moving steadily throughout.
See, I like
the threat
that,
of the army coming towards them. It's not for me. It's not what I – talking from an intellectual level, it's not the stuff that I like.
Yeah.
The second tick is the fact that he limits it to three point of view characters.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how good that is. Yes, the book slips around in time. We go back to the past, back to the future. Well, not the future, past and present. But it's it's Aya.
I-A.
So, Aya. How do you know how to pronounce them, out of curiosity?
Because I asked Ben. Because I got like a third of the way through the book and I was saying her name in three different ways and it's like, no, I need to get that in my head.
So she emailed him and asked him.
I DM'd him on Twitter and said, how do you say her name?
So it was again IA.
IA.
IA and Zaphir.
I only asked him about IA. Oh, yeah, okay. The rest I thought I could make a good guess at.
I'm going to just say Zaphir and Berulian.
I was saying Zaphir.
There are three, more or less, three point of view characters. Yep. That's so fucking refreshing because a bunch of the fantasy novels I've read this year have 4,000 bloody point of view characters.
Really?
And you just get lost and you just stop giving a shit. Or in the worst case with The Emperor's Blade, it has also three point of view characters. But the third one, the woman, gets about 10 pages. So that's more insulting for a whole completely different reason. Like the Cameron Hurley has too many point of view characters. And, you know, that was one of the great things about Goblin Emperor. We're stuck in the one person's head for the whole story. That's what I really liked. But this is as well focused. It's on these three people. It's about their story. It's their arc. All that sort of novelistic shit, which is good. Great. But did I love this book? No, because it has some of those fantastical conventions that just don't do it for me. It's not that it's specifically grimdark because
I don't think it is grimdark at all.
Which it's not. That's what I was going about to say.
Right,
there is a grittiness to it, but I think I'm getting tired of people.
I think there's a realism to it.
Well, there's a realism and grittiness to it, which I'm getting tired of people thinking therefore is then in a grimdark title. I mean, the word shit is mentioned a couple of times, but there's no fucks. I did a check. I couldn't find a fuck in the whole novel. There is a...
But you didn't have it on an e-reader, so you can't be 100% sure.
I can't be sure. There's no... and there is violence, but... But it's not dwelled on, and there's no rape.
No.
Did you notice? There's not even – I don't think – I can't remember a scene where even sexual violence is hinted at, let alone
– No. There's a remarkable gender equality throughout this world,
can I just say it's remarkably free of rape. People say fantasy novels, oh, well, you know, you're writing of a particular – based on a particular time period.
But it's interesting,
rape was happened back then.
But why is it, though?
Comment voice
again. But why is it, though?
What? Because it's not about kingdoms fighting.
No, it's even more simple than that. Why is there no rape in this book pervasively or even incidentally?
Because women are of a higher power level. Like there's five queens.
There is essentially.
The person who runs the city of Mir is a woman. One of the better sell swords, or I'll use the George R. R. Martin term, one of the better mercenaries is a woman, the Steel. Is that what you mean? That they're on
in the most simple way, there is an equality in this world. There is an equality between the genders.
Yeah, there is there is brief mentions that across the border or elsewhere, doesn't exist.
Yes. Yeah.
But here it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when you have everyone considered people. Of course, you're still going to have crimes, and there probably is some rape in the world, and murders, and theft, yeah, and all this sort of stuff. But it's not something.
But I just want to say to our listeners, if you're looking for a fantasy novel remarkably free of rape, because I can't really say that for many that I've read this year.
So this is The Rapeless by
Ben. This is The Rapeless by. I know. We should just stand on a thing and cheer it.
No,
just,
I think that that's a really good point. But I think, but that's what you get when you build a world
dynamics
where gender equality is. It's not trumpeted, it's not remarked upon by anyone, because much the same as with the China Miéva book Embassy Town that we discussed a couple of years ago, where it's just not remarked upon. This society doesn't have inequality between the genders. Yep. Not one gender is considered better or worse or weaker or stronger than the other. And it's not something that's ever remarked upon in the book, because that's just the way it is. You would remark upon it no more than you would remark upon the fact that the sky is blue. And this is what Pika set up in this particular world. It's not a remarkable thing because it's just how it is.
I think so therefore
you don't have some of the nastier expressions of inequality between genders, such as rape.
Yep. So big ticks for me. But I can't be bothered with armies sieging other places. It's just a
Well, the siege was fair. Like, it wasn't actually a siege. They did kind of get around it. So it's not like half the book was them in siege.
But there's that constant threat of this particular force of religious fanatics coming towards
the
city.
Who are right, as you point out.
Who are right. Who are actually correct.
You know, this is not a faith-based extremism that...
Yeah, I mean, he gets around some of the cliches like this isn't about, I thought this was going to be, how she learns how to use her skill type novel.
I love that there were no literary equivalent of the learn to fight montage in this book.
Yeah, correct. Or the sort of Harry Potter.
She's already learned how to fight.
Yeah, she already knows. She comes into the novel. Yeah. It's interesting also that she's an immigrant, but not treated poorly as an immigrant,
a refugee,
which again was another nice element to the book.
Well, it's like I really appreciated with this book the diverse ethnicity, because everyone's physical appearance is described.
Yep.
So, you know, if you have brown skin, you have brown skin. If you have white skin, you have white skin. And it's described.
But it's like he's created this city that's as close to a fantasy utopia as you're going to get in this world of fantasy, big fat fantasy novels. Because people do, there's gender equality, there are refugees, but they're not, you know, spurned. The only thing that people are spurned are for is if they're cursed, if they've got the evil magic radiation. That's when they're cursed. But generally, this is a place that seems, and it's got trade, it trades with everyone, it's a hub.
Well, this particular city, because, you know.
I'm not saying the world is, I'm saying this city.
To have refugees, you have to have problems somewhere in the world.
No, I'm not saying that this is a non-problem. Clearly not a non-problematic world. Shit happens in it, but this particular place is great. Spoilers, the fact that he fucks it completely by the end of the novel is a great is a genuine tragedy. Yeah. You've taken this really nice city.
This is why we can't have nice things.
No, well, in a sense, it sort of feels that way. We can't have nice things. We have to fucking break them. And he breaks it. And it's sad. But it was too long. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's funny.
I've read too many of these now. Maybe this has come at reading this book has come at a point where I've read a bunch of these books that are all about 500 to 600 pages long. Elizabeth Baer, Cameron Hurley, the Brian Staverley, Goblin Emperor, the Abercrombie actually is quite short because it's a young adult novel, but those four just there. Yeah. All of them are at least 150,000 words. This is a bit shorter than that, but I
thought it was
I can't deal with the length.
In some risks, like I agree with you, it's a lot. I didn't feel like I never felt that it was bogged down, but at the same time,
well, no one goes on a long arduous quest.
There are no quests.
No, there are missions, but not quests.
Yes, which is different.
It is different.
There are like military missions. You need to go and do this thing, and you do the thing, and it's done. But I felt like he was. Obviously, because it's the first book in what will be a trilogy, and he's in this first book, he's got to lay the groundwork for what this world is, how it works, how, you know, essentially the rules of the world, right? So there's a lot to put in a first book, and I think maybe some of the a fleshing out of character may have suffered because of there is a lot of exposition, and mostly it's done very skillfully.
And mostly in the first half.
And again, that might just be another reason why I tend to bounce off this kind of book, because I'm dealing and processing all of that intellectually, and here's this world, and here's how it works, and blah blah blah, and it's not, I guess, not giving me the breathing space to to really connect with what's happening in that world.
So there are little things like...
again, not...
AI? Have I got that wrong? Or IA?
IA,
yeah. She's has a boyfriend at the start.
Yeah, the horrible soldier guy.
And I think we're meant to feel some sort of sympathy when he gets essentially terribly mutilated towards the last third, because he was a non-entity to me because he was an arsehole from the get-go.
Yeah.
And never was anything different. So there were these little things like that that...
I think there wasn't enough fleshing out of some of these things, but you want the book to be another 100 pages on top
no,
of
No, I don't. But then maybe I would take that and not have the plot centered around religious zealots coming... I think there's enough going on around, even just around Zafer's backstory and all that could have...
That's what I mean. There's so much in this
book.
But
who the fuck am I? I'm not a fantasy trilogy writer. So, you know, I understand what, you know, he needs to tell an action-packed adventure-type story. This is the sort of thing that this is one of the conventions of this particular genre. It just bores me silly sometimes. That's all.
In this particular book?
Well, there are parts of this book, where I got, all the battle stuff in the last third. Well, not battle, but the storming of the castle, in a sense. I thought, I don't know. For me, it was skimmable. And as much as I like the conclusion, there's a certain predictability to what happens at the end as well in terms of all the threads coming together, for me. But a certain predictability. You know, that her power really emerges towards the end, which, again, annoying that it's a final battle between the keepers and, pushing pieces into place. You can see it.
There's definite movements in the book that you follow, and they end up where. But
it's very it's very hard to attack Peake on this stuff, given that
I'm saying this is part of the other
novels that do exactly the same thing. He gets so much right. It was annoying that for those elements. That's all. Why does that generate a laugh?
No. It's just your face. See, this is the problem. People can't see your face.
Well, I'm not Ben. If you're listening to this, I'm not making a strange face. I'm just
a little bit strange. Oh. I just wanted to read, because one of the reviews that I came across had this, had never thought of it, and I don't agree, but it was a really interesting reading of the book. It was actually on Pornokitch.
Did you mention that the book is rape-free? Because I really do want to stress that, because we really should.
The reviewer, who actually I have not written the name down, that is terrible, Jared is all I have. So Jared from Pornokitch, I will provide a link in the show notes, read this book as a secondary world allegory for 9/11 and its cultural, political and military fallout.
What?
I know. Which I thought was really interesting.
The gods as the Twin Towers.
Well, he goes and say, a nation secure in its power ignores the obvious warning signs and the fact that it is literally built on the blood of another culture's beliefs. When Lyra, a neighbouring country that's long deemed barbaric and beneath notice, attacks, all of Miera's casual assumptions fall by the wayside. This is a book about a group of people realising the world they believed in is tumbling down around them, that there's a hatred out there they didn't even know about, much less take seriously.
That's not how I read the book.
No.
Fascinating, isn't it?
I can see what he's getting at, but I guess the discomfort I would have with that reading is that the gods are fucking real.
Yeah. Yeah. This idea of a city built on the culture of a culture that you know has been appropriated or subsumed or whatever.
Well, they are under the earth.
There's a city underneath the earth. Yes, I get that. But it's not like the city on top is completely denying the existence of the god or the gods or, you know.
I just found it a fascinating reading. I don't agree. I don't know how much it would stand out. But then a commentator on the bottom of that review was talking about how they saw the book as more, I guess, an allegory about climate change and the old world dying and people. It's so interesting that you can overlay this with so many.
You know what's interesting about that? How this feeds back into your first point about the mythic versus mimesis spectrum.
Yeah.
The two people are saying allegory, are using the term allegory in a book where the gods are real. So there's really no allegory in a sense.
But it is for us because this isn't our world.
No, I know that, but.
So if this is how you read mythic fiction by way of allegory, by way of what is this fiction telling us about our world, then you have to overlay, because it is mythic. It's not mimetic. We're not looking at our world here. This is demonstrably not our world. That's funny. One review I came across was talking about how, oh, this could be science fiction. It could be set in the future. It's like, really? Where did the gods get here?
Well, no, that's not entirely, because you see, I did get this faint impression that there might have been gods before the gods.
Look, it's interesting though too, because for me and it's never really, I don't know if it will be in later books, it's never really kind of explicitly talked about in The Godless, but just definitionally, what are the gods? Are they?
It's a good question.
Are they, like, what are they? And by virtue of the fact that they were just big and powerful, they have the right to be obeyed or followed
I mean? The term god is a very charged word. It means something
it's
to
like,
us.
It's like, what are these beings that were apparently once doing
and
stuff?
And it's fascinating
that
the term afterlife comes very late in the novel. Because you always associate god and the belief in a god with a belief in an afterlife.
Well, you have all the ghosts, right? The ghosts follow Zephyr around.
Correct.
Because now there is nowhere for them to go because the god of death is dead. So,
but there's still no real conception of there's no conception in this world, at least in this particular city, of an afterlife beyond death to me.
But you become a ghost and you just wander around forever.
Zephyr knows that because he can see them.
Oh, you mean like a popular?
Yeah,
well, no, the idea is that maybe there is no afterlife. I mean, this is, in a way, this is kind of the horror at the heart of this novel is that if the gods were real and there was an afterlife, obviously of some kind, and now that they're dead, if once people die, you just become this ghost that wanders around the earth forever that no one can see unless you're a god.
Or cursed.
It doesn't map. I can't actually take that mythic and map it to stuff.
Well,
so,
Jared has.
Yeah, to 9/11 or to climate change, as the other person thought, which is interesting. I quite like that. But
I just mapped it to the basic thing of a society looking to move on and being dragged forcibly back.
Yeah, but again, it's not moving on from a belief or a way of cultural interaction that we now decide isn't maybe good for everyone or.
They're fossils.
It's from
now.
Real.
They're dinosaurs. Yeah. They're fossils. They're dead.
But they were real, though, you know?
Yeah, they were real. Yeah. Well, dinosaurs were real, too.
Yeah. We never took our morality from dinosaurs.
maybe we should have.
Maybe we should.
Okay, so now that we're circling back to the point that we started with, should we move on to the next book?
Yes, okay. Again, I'm quite glad I read The Godless. I just think. just made me realize I'm really not the reader for these kind of books. You know, my tastes run more closer to the mimetic end of the spectrum than the mythic, with a heavy dose of metafiction. So,
the next book is Leviathan's
Blood, which refers to the ocean that one of the gods died in, and now the ocean is his blood, which rose. Sea levels rising. See, climate change.
Very good.
I was quite intrigued by that kind of a reading. I'd like to sit down and have a chat with that commenter and go, so how are you mapping climate change? That's fascinating.
You go and do that now while we talk about The Book of the Unnamed Midwife by Meg Ellison, which is the book I recommended.
Yes, and you had read it.
Yes, I had read it and quite liked it. This novel won the Philip K. Dick Award, which was this year's Philip K. Dick Award. Which is for paperbacks published in the previous year.
Which I did not know. I did not know it was paperback specific. So I have learnt something.
I was hesitant.
Hesitant?
To recommend this book, not because I didn't like it, I quite loved it, but because it's another post-apocalyptic novel and I thought you would kill me. Because, we did already did Station 11 this year and... I just thought, how many can I be recommended?
How many can you make me read?
Yes. But I thought this one had a different take.
I agree with you.
And a really fascinating take. So essentially a plague has come along. It's wiped out most of the population.
Yep.
But the bulk of the population it's wiped out are women.
Yep. And children.
And children. The majority who have survived are men. Now, as I say in my review, this sort of is the setup for a, you know, rape fantasy, misogynistic sort of men ruling women and lots of non-consensual sex sort of novel. But it's not that.
It's a bit more complicated than that.
Far more complicated.
I mean, it is that. But it's also far more complicated.
Well, yes, but it's not a book that dwells not the right word. It's not a book that focuses. Well, for one, its point of view character is not one of those men, but instead.
Well, I think it does focus on exactly that. That's the entire focus of the book.
Well, I mean, in a gratuitous way.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but that's what's so fascinating about it.
Now, we're not ever the title sort of gives it away, but we're not ever given the name of the main character.
We're not. She goes through a variety of pseudonyms that she chooses for herself. So correct. at any one part of the book, we know her as a different name.
But she's interesting because she's a midwife.
Yep.
And she realizes pretty quickly, because I think she works in a hospital at the start of the book, that one of the symptoms of this plague is if you give birth to a child, both you and the child will die.
One of the effects of the plague, because it begins with a lot of babies being stillborn and mothers dying during or shortly after childbirth from a fever.
So once she's sort of come to terms with the fact that half the world's fucked, if not more, she starts going around looking to essentially sterilise.
Well, also, let me just take you back 1 second.
Was that inaccurate?
No, but you left something out, which is really important, I think. Because remember, one of the things that I didn't like about Station 11 was the Uber plague that infected incredibly fast and killed just about everyone and had obviously an incubation period that was long. And you cannot have those three things.
Yeah.
I think what this book did, which I think is actually clever, is that kind of like 30 days later, where you have someone who just wakes up in hospital and he's been in a coma for 30 days, so you completely elide what actually happened, is the same thing happens to her, because our midwife gets sick of the plague and she's hooked up in hospital to some kind of life support or whatever, and she's one of the very few who do actually just naturally survive the plague. But we have no idea the length of time she spent. And because this book is written mostly from her point of view, we don't get the nitty gritties and the details of stuff. So there's nothing there to kind of make you go, well, now that wouldn't have happened. So we don't know whether she was like, because in Station 11, it took like a week or something, right? So that she could have been out for 2 months. I mean, it's all very, like, it's very clever. It's very clever to elide a lot of that detail. And we still don't know, even though there's a bit of omniscient narration in the book, exactly what we're talking about in terms of incubation periods, infection rates and everything around the world.
No, we know the symptoms, not necessarily the cause.
Yeah, so that's a really, really clever way of getting around that whole.
It could be called a cheat.
It could be a cheat, or it could be just, well, I'm not going to focus on this. So it's like 30 days later. I never. It's not the focus.
Yeah, I didn't care. Yeah. I didn't think of it as a cheat.
And I didn't either. I think it's a really clever way of addressing something that's not important to the book.
Yeah,
without just going, oh, here's this really massive quick plague that killed everyone. Bang! Now let's start the book. It's like no, it's more complicated than that. But she doesn't know.
Now,
and she has a good reason for not knowing.
One of the things about Station 11 that I loved and that you sort of liked, but you had other issues, was that Station 11 does push itself as a book where there's hope.
Yeah.
That humanity will, in reminding ourselves of why we're good, humanity can sort of bring back that which, well, it's lost it only because of so many people have been wiped out, but we can remind ourselves of when we were at our greatest and somehow get back to that, not the exact
ourselves that there's more to living than just survival, I think is the thesis of Station 11.
Correct.
And this book does this too.
It does, but very differently though.
Yeah.
And it's really not until the end that the book is structured very strangely. Okay, so it's both sort of like the diary entries of our midwife.
Yeah, so she's keeping a journal as she goes.
But it's also set in the future, and a group of women who are together who are essentially midwives themselves, who sort of are a religious group, you could say.
I think they're just a community.
They feel religious in nature, and that their actions and their deeds are based on what this our main character.
Yeah, but and that and you're right. There is a tone of veneration and, yes, and almost of the sacred about treating
veneration,
treating these journals of the book of the unnamed midwife, yeah, which is the book that the framing device of this novel is the transcription of this book over and correct, over, much as because again we're living in where there is no printing presses, so you need to make multiple copies and yeah, disseminate them and so
well,
on.
Well, this is a gospel. I mean, this is the point. So there is a religious tone to
but
it.
But whether it's but that and that I think has come from the fact that this data is incredibly important. That the data that's in the book of the unnamed midwife is how to survive.
Yes.
And the record of what happened and the clues for what the plague was. So it's important. And yes, that has transmuted to a quasi-religious veneration of these documents. But at its core, because as the sister Inna, I think is her name, I yep, can't quite remember, as she says, this is important information and you need to know this. Not everyone, though. It's only a select few who get to transcribe the unadulterated entire book of the midwife, because some of this stuff is a bit too much for the common people, you get the impression. So only a select group of scribes every year get the whole book that they have, because they have to transcribe the whole book.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, so it's so there is this, and again, I think it's this very it feels like a very believable,
yeah, it does.
Natural veneration
also
of these
documents. What she also does is that she's got those elements, but then she also has these omniscient moments where she sort of says what's going on in the rest of the world to
yeah,
a degree. So she gives it a global sense as well. It's not just – it could easily have been just the journals of this unnamed
life. Outside that framing device.
Yes, that's right. Which
within
you could argue from a structural point of view is a complete mess. You could argue it's breaking all the rules of writing. You could argue how dare you, Meg Ellison, for jumping outside the structure you'd set, but actually is fucking awesome.
But she hasn't really set a structure. The structure is the structure she's writing with.
I know that, but there are certain things that piss people off when it comes to, you know, because you're going to, okay, you can accept the journal entries. That's, you know, how many books have been written with that. You can accept sort of a third person look at a society that's been built as a result of those journal entries. But then to have on top of that an omniscient sort of narrator that gives us a global take, that may be one step too many for some people from a structural point of view. And I think it's actually one of the strongest bits of this book.
I think it works really well. I think if the whole book had been the midwife's journals in the way they're written, and I love the way they're written. It's really good.
She's
like
very engaging.
The abbreviations and the truncated sentences and all of this sort of stuff. It's a fantastic way of journaling.
Well, there's a sense of immediacy, but it's also engaging.
And you'll have noticed, because I did, because it didn't commit one of the cardinal sins that I freaking hate in literary journals and epistolary novels and stuff, where reams and reams of dialogue that's just in what is supposedly a journal. And the way she can get around that is by giving you very direct scenes, not in journal form,
yes,
in a more traditional narrative.
That's right.
So the journals themselves are very compact, very concise, have such a strong voice from
yeah, that's
the
right.
Midwife.
And that's why I didn't explain it correctly. Yeah, we leave the journal into more just basic.
And it's not even chapter by chapter.
No,
it's within chapters.
Correct. So
it's almost like, in fact, what you could look at it as is, instead of saying, oh, yeah, well, there's all these journals and that gets interrupted by these third-person things. It's like, no. Here's the story being told, and it's illustrated by extracts from the journals.
Yeah. Well, like it's sort of like a scrapbook or an annotated approach.
Yeah.
It's an annotation, yeah.
It's like a bricolage of how you are going to
wow, you've said
tell this
great
narrative.
Veneration and bricolage. Wow.
So this is the story, because it's not like there's just tiny little bits of third-person narration. It's a great chunk. In fact, I think there's more of it than the journal entries themselves. So really the journal entries are they're illustrative. That they're showing you. It's like, here's the story and here's this bit I'm going to stick in so you can see exactly in her own words kind of what happened.
So the point I was making, and you haven't interrupted, it's just we went on a tangent.
Yeah.
The point I was making about 20 minutes ago was that where you could argue that the hope or there's got to be something more than survival of Station 11 isn't earned, because, you know, the virus happens in 5 minutes and suddenly everyone's talking Shakespeare. It feels earned in this novel far more.
It feels earned.
Because it feels like a natural progression, and it's more than just about cultural things that will be – it's about survival. It's about the hope around survival.
Yeah.
More than
– and it's hard. It
yes,
is hard.
And it's hard. Yes, thank
right.
you.
It's hard, but it's also even before you get to the end and get to Fort Nowhere and there's a community that's happening there, like throughout the book – the midwife and her various companions, they have moments where, you know, they find a safe, warm place to, they find some wonderful food. Yep. They have books to read. They find a portable DVD player and a whole bunch of, you know, there is a sense that throughout the whole thing that life isn't just about survival, right?
And these
moments are really important.
And they're just not, and they're not just husks of human beings walking through surviving.
No.
And that's the bit that I love the most.
I mean,
the eroticism of the novel.
Well, it's funny because, like I said, one of the things I loved was the fact that at one point she stocks up on vibrators and batteries.
That's right.
Awesome.
How different is that? You take the road. It's literally husks of people. They're everything that has made them be what they are has been ripped away.
Yeah. You go, well, why would you keep living?
Correct. And yes, Mandel in her novel is trying to turn that around and say no, there is something more. But this, it just feels so more natural and human in that it's, I want to fuck. I want to shag. I still want to shag. Yeah, all right, everyone's dead.
I want to just hold someone's hand.
I want to hold
sometimes.
Someone. I want to play with a vibrator. There will be times. I love the fact that she's horny.
Yeah, because we're human.
But this is new to me. To read this.
Yeah.
Not the horniness. That happens to me every so often. Probably too much information. But in this novel, it's so new that Ellison would infuse that erotic element or that need to have not just intimacy but fucking.
Yeah.
Just the need to fuck is in the book.
Yes.
There's a negative to it. And the point I was making before is that this is not an extended rape fantasy, which is a tick.
Yeah.
But there are men out there who are running around looking for women who they can
be
terrible to.
One woman for every 10 men.
Plus there's also women setting up their own little hives.
Mm. I loved the use of hive as that word because it was so wrong and so perfect in the way humans get things wrong.
Correct.
You know, it's exactly what you would call it, even though it's so wrong.
So you've got these women who are essentially going, well, we're surrounded by men, so let's control them. And we can do that with our, you know, appendages.
Vajayjays.
Yeah, vajayjays, correct. And so they set up these hives, which...
They're harems, essentially.
Yes, which also brilliant stuff.
You know, and the male and male intimacy too, because you have, you know, when you have men who would otherwise ostensibly be heterosexual in a world where there is a scarcity of women, it doesn't mean that... What I loved about it is it didn't mean for some men, but not all men and not even, I don't think, most men, it didn't automatically go to, oh, women are scarce, I must get one and rape one. And some men re-engineer their...
Well, first people she comes across...
Their needs for intimacy.
Which is still in the city are two gay guys.
Yeah. But even if men are, like... pre this world were sensibly heterosexual.
Yeah, that's right.
They can re-engineer that within themselves to a certain extent to accommodate the need for intimacy and the need for sex and the need for romance. And I found that really interesting that it wasn't, you know, the book, despite how it began, the book wasn't set up as, well, this is it, all men are rapists. And
That's the point I was making before.
Yeah.
That's why I love this book so much. I want to.
I mean, it kind of starts out that way. It's like, grrr.
But it's not necessarily an angry book, is what I'm.
I think it's a really angry book.
We're going to talk about different types of anger here. It's passionate and raw, but
I think there's a very strong and unapologetic and no need to apologize for it. There's a really strong current of anger throughout the whole book. I mean, I love that
toward men or toward just. The way things are.
When you say men, I would say patriarchy.
Okay.
So let's be clear. I'm not talking about all men are evil. I'm talking about the patriarchal structures are evil. And I love that at its core, and it never flinches from it, this entire book is essentially about reproductive rights.
Yes.
That's what it's about.
Yep.
This is a science fiction novel about reproductive rights.
As I was saying, she goes around saying, she says, look, we're fucked. People can't give birth anymore. It's not going to happen.
It's far too risky.
It's far too risky.
Because the babies always die is what she's thinking at that point.
The only solution.
And the women almost always die.
Is for women to be sterilized. It's the only. And she.
Well, when you say sterilized, she's not operating on women.
No, no.
She's giving them birth control.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, to take birth control, sorry.
Yeah.
But to not have children.
So she raised pharmacies to get all sorts of.
Contrasts this by she comes across some Mormons. Which is the middle part of the book, the Mormon bit. And
I really love that bit. I love that bit in the forest in the house.
But she didn't make fun of the Mormons.
The forest in the house. The house in the forest.
But did you notice that she didn't make fun of the Mormons specifically?
No, she didn't. And I saw a couple of reviews saying, oh, she gives them a bit of a dig. And it's like, I don't think she did. I don't think she was not making fun of the church or the beliefs.
Well, they bring her in. They bring her in.
Yeah.
There is a willful ignorance on their part that they send their men out to fucking get murdered.
Well, it's not willful ignorance. I mean, this is part of they're doing that deliberately. It's
that's right, to lower the amount of men. So, yeah, there's none to get around. Sorry, that's right.
But that's not like, oh, look how evil the Mormons are. That's like, again, this is a group of people who are
trying to survive.
As people do, leveraging religion for their own
ends. I'm cynical, I expected the penny to drop and for them to be the they send their men out on purpose, but for them to be this evil bunch of Mormons who have set up their own harem of women. But it's never like that. They're actually very open, very, very pleasant.
Like when she was there, I kept this whole book, like for most of the book anyway, there's just this tension that runs through it. And you're right there with her as she's trying to survive and trying to avoid
people.
And
is completely untrustworthy in every single human that she comes across.
Overhauls her physical appearance and her manner of dress and her manner of holding herself and walking and
that's one thing we haven't mentioned. She dresses like a man.
To masquerade as a man because it's safer for her to be a lone man walking. Like it's immeasurably safer for her to be a lone man walking around and getting lots of talk and high fives from other men rather than
I've got a comment on my review of the book. So sorry to interrupt because I know we were talking about the Mormons, but we may get back to the Mormons.
We'll probably get back to them.
Because it just segues nicely. And this person said that if the main protagonist dresses like a man, walks like a man and talks like a man, and in some ways thinks like a man, why not just make her a man?
That kind of misses the whole point of the book.
Well, to survive in this new world, it seems women have to do what many believe they have to do in this world, which is outman the men. Why can't she be a woman who survives as a woman?
But she's surviving as a woman.
Well, not externally.
She has to masquerade. Yeah, because for survival, she has to masquerade as a man to avoid being captured and tortured and raped and forced to give birth. Because that's what happens to a lot of women who are wandering around on their own. But I think that misses the whole point of the book. The book is about, as a woman in a world like this, how do you survive? And part of the way you survive is to mimic, as, let's face it,
the predator.
A lot of animals and birds and insects and plants in nature rely on mimicry to either survive or to hunt or to deter predators because they look like something poisonous or they just look like one of the predators. Mimicry is an established survival mechanism on Earth in our biodiversity. It's a very clever way to do it.
And I don't think our midwife is a Sigourney Weaver type, a Ripley type character who's all butch and kicking ass.
And the thing is she's masquerading as a man.
Yes.
So she's wearing
male
clothes.
She's not identifying as a man.
No, and she's not trying, I don't like comment out manning the men. She's not. It's a masquerade. She lowers her voice. She changes the way she moves and stands. She wears male clothes. She binds her breasts. She puts charcoal on her cheek. I mean, because she's very filthy anyway, because you know, hot and cold running water anymore.
It's
a masquerade.
It's acknowledgement, as you said, from Ellison saying, you know what? It'd be ridiculous for her to walk around in a dress and lipstick in this world or whatever. To follow the conventional stereotypical female attributes. She needs to survive, and it's an acknowledgement that to survive when the main predator is a man is to mimic that. I like that.
And again, I'll emphasize that it is mimicry. She's not trying to be a man. No. She's not trying to outman. She's not acting like a man, right? Not when she's alone and she's in her private.
I mean, she's good with a gun.
You know,
she does kill a couple of men with guns, competent. But she's not Rambo. She's not going around, blowing people away.
No,
but
she's assuming a disguise.
Yes.
And that is not the same as saying, okay, well, then I need to be a man to survive in the man's world. No, she's just saying, I need to present as a man to other men to survive in this world. And I think that's like it's a subtle distinction, but I think it's really important to make. She's not trying to be a man, nor does she want to be a man, nor does she change her behaviours.
No, that's the key thing. Nor does she want to be a man.
No.
That's not – it's entirely – survival.
No, and she does not change her behavior in private.
Correct.
And once she is with the Mormon couple, Honus and Jody, and it's safe, and she realizes
she reveals
it's safe,
who she is.
And then she's just who she is. it's not like she's it trying to outman the men. It's it's a survival mechanism. It's mimicry. That's it. And that's, I think, the difference. The other thing I really liked about it is that we have a protagonist here who's a bisexual character, and there's very little made of that. Like, you know, it's not a huge part of her story. It's not something that necessarily has a massive influence on any particular plot development, apart from the fact that she has a little bit of a crush on both Jodie and Honus at one point. But, I mean, that's it. It's just part of who she is, and there's not a massive big deal made of it, which I really liked. It is very, very rare to have bisexual characters who aren't either raging nymphomaniacs or collecting the whole set people or evil bisexuals or some other hideous kind of stereotype.
But talking about stereotypes, this commenter also noted that there are two stereotypes in the commenter's view, of the whore and the virgin. So you've got Roxanne, pole dancer.
Oh, okay.
And then Jodie, the Mormon.
Okay, yeah.
And you have those two stereotypes, which this person raises a critique of the book. It's as a white patriarchy man, whatever. Yeah. It's not something that impressed upon me.
I think I can see the point. I think it's the same commentator.
Yeah.
So I think, as with the comment about why doesn't she just be a man, I think that's a very simplistic reading of what's happening. Because, yes, you do have Jodie, who's the Mormon, who was a virgin until she married Honus.
Yep.
And supported in that role by her community. And you have Roxanne, who was a pole dancer and I think also a prostitute in Vegas.
Yeah, I think so.
And so on. And yes, on the face of it, these are, yeah, it is. It is absolute. But I think it's deliberate, because what she does with both those characters is deconstruct what those stereotypes are and actually turn them into people. So Jodie isn't just the virgin and Roxanne isn't just the whore. That is a small part of who they are or who they were.
Yeah.
And as people, they're so much bigger than that. And I think that's also very important. Important to normalize.
I think that's the key point, the secondary characters that the midwife meets along the way are all the ones who have screen time, are all fleshed out. They're all
absolutely.
They've all got depth. There's even Honus. You know, I think he's fantastic.
I really liked Honus by the end.
Because he's that
so
little,
naive.
He has that innocence, and yet I assumed he was going to – yes, I can't help myself. I thought he was going to be one of those violent types who was going to be an asshole. But he's just such a – he's actually just a genuinely good person.
Yeah, and I think –
not nice, good.
But I think one of the interesting things that this book does is – and I think it's rare that a book does this so well with such immediacy is you are incredibly immersed in the mindset of the character. Like, I found this almost unremitting tension throughout the book. And as you say, I felt that too, because you are there, as Dusty is, as she was at the point with Honus and Jodie, as she's in any of her incarnations, she's constantly alert. And that's what you are as a reader. Yep. Every situation,
everyone's
going to
be an ass.
You are checking the corners, you are checking. Like, there's that moment when she, and I can't remember exactly where it was, but it's one of the houses that she finds and she goes in. And I'm reading it and I'm expecting someone to attack her overnight, and it doesn't happen. And you realize you are in as high a state of alert and awareness of quote unquote your surroundings as the character is. And it is quite remarkable for a book. Well, for me anyway, for a book to pull me in that immersively so that I am so aligned with how the character is feeling that I'm surprised when nothing happens.
Yeah, it's
you know, oh, he was a nice guy after all. Oh, she got a good night's sleep.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. You know, yeah. He was a nice guy after all. Yeah, that's right. The Mormons weren't like cannibals, really, or whatever other horrible thing that you can think of.
I think part of that is that undoubtedly this book is feeding off the zeitgeist, as you were, of this type of post-apocalyptic fiction, where in most books and movies, the bad, always the worst is what happens and blah. So it is part of that genre, so that's already kind of set up for you to have those expectations. But I think the book itself does it so well. Like, it maintains the tension of this character. You're exhausted reading it almost, because you're just constantly on edge.
And it's not a long book. It's not a short book.
It's quite short. Yeah, so I did really enjoy it. I really loved the fact that it was overwhelmingly told from this woman's perspective, that the things that would affect women in this type of a world were front and center. So birth control,
yes,
you know, and reproduction, and even if there wasn't a plague, even if there wasn't this, you know, like a pregnancy will actually kill you almost every single time, still birth control would be really important. And it's not something you see in fact, I can't think of a single book where I've seen that, where I've seen the idea of in a post-apocalyptic book, in a book or a film or a TV show,
because
where women are running around in the pharmacy saying, oh, fuck, thank God, they've got the pill.
And this is what she plays against. The natural inclination is everyone's dead, we've got to repopulate.
Yeah.
And as quickly as possible.
But even if you do want to repopulate, you want to control that shit.
You don't want to
do it when you're in a really unsafe place.
No, apparently you don't. You just want to you've got no infrastructure. You know, babies are not easy to bring into this world. They don't just come out fully, you know, made.
No, especially in non-sterile conditions.
Correct. No, we're just going to repopulate, you know. So you're right. That's the fact that this book pushes against that very notion that, yeah, all right, half the population or three quarters of the population is gone. We just got to pop out babies. Is brilliant.
Yeah,
just on its own.
But as I said, even in a world where this wasn't the case, even if
that's
it was
what I'm
just,
saying,
you know,
50, no, that's what I'm saying,
50-50 survivors.
Yeah,
even if
the babies were likely to come
out
okay. Yeah, you know, you're 100% correct.
I think most women would be running around scavenging for birth
control. Isn't this a fucking awesome book?
I think I just want to read because I found she doesn't have a huge online presence, but she does have a little blog on WordPress, and she wrote...
This is Meg Ellison we're talking
about. Oh, yes, sorry, Meg Ellison, the author. And I read a little bit that she wrote about why she wrote the book. And she, first of all, she loves the post-apocalyptic genre, she said. And she's fascinated by group dynamics and how culture shifts and change and so on. But she said, but most of these works, that is a whole bunch of things that she's read and watched, do not account at all for how different the loss of the modern world impacts women differently than it does men. Imagine if every woman you know suddenly lost access to birth control and then lost any bodily autonomy that the rule of law and decency of her community afforded her. Imagine if every woman on The Walking Dead somehow didn't find the time to shave her armpits every week but spent hours raiding pharmacies for the pill and calculating how long before they all expire. Imagine that the structure in The Handmaid's Tale that allocated the few remaining fertile women to the men in power never materialised and instead they were hunted and treated as a commodity. And it's just, you know, the line about if every woman suddenly lost access to birth control and lost bodily autonomy and the rule of decency and law were suspended, and it's like, hi, America, how you going? So I think there is this anger that runs through the book, and I think it's a justified anger. And, yeah, it was incredibly refreshing to have a book which made these issues front and centre. They are what the book is about. The book is about reproductive rights and bodily autonomy. That's it. That is the primary concern of this book. And I think it's amazing.
Here's the terrible thing. It's not what I focused on when I wrote about the book.
No, I know you focused on the eroticism. But no, I mean, don't you think that's remarkable?
I do.
And more remakable that it wins an award, being
absolutely
a book focused on reproductive health.
And also was long-listed for the Tiptree. In fact, I would have knocked off one of the books of the Tiptree that drew and put this on instead. But that's, you know, I don't have a say.
But it is a book that looks at...
No, but I want to go back to that, what I just said. Yeah, I didn't focus on that birth control stuff. Obviously, clearly important to the book.
Every woman she meets is like, here, I have some birth control.
I was more interested, I don't know why, but, well, is it a man thing? I don't know. I was more interested in the fact that this is a woman who's still, in spite of the dangers, actually, because, you know, of what happens to women when they get pregnant, et cetera, still wants to live in a world where she can have pleasure and fuck and be intimate.
Which, if there is birth control and reproductive autonomy, doesn't have to mean pregnancy.
Yes, I understand, yeah.
But that's the whole argument, right?
Yeah.
That you need this. We need this stuff now. Forget, you know, post-apocalyptic, blah, blah. This is what we need now. And this is getting chipped away right now.
You know the point I'm trying to make? Birth control is not an issue to me, even though it clearly is an issue to me.
There you go.
It is an issue to me. Absolutely it is.
Yeah, but it's not something that
you... We only want two kids.
But it's not something that you, personally, yourself, have to think about every day.
Correct. So when I'm reading this book, it's not the thing that jumps out at me as being the big idea of the novel.
Yeah.
It's more the fact that, yeah, it's this is a woman who still wants to, yeah, be sexual. Be sexual.
Yeah, because
But then me not joining the links about a woman who wants to be sexual but doesn't want to be popping out. Forget the babies could die and she would die as a result. Just doesn't want to be popping out babies anyway. I'm not making that link.
Yeah, but it's a link that every woman, every fertile woman has to make.
This is why I need to do these books with you, because these pennies don't drop until we have these discussions.
Yeah, it's
But I think that's interesting for my own prejudices and biases.
Yeah.
There we go.
To
bring it back to the start of the podcast.
And I the other thing I did love about this book, that it's unapologetic about female sexuality.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
You know, it's not coy about it. It's not.
No, but although to be fair, she is she is careful with the Mormons, Jodie, and she doesn't just ram it down their throat from
minute. But it's respectful. And I was just about to say, even though for our midwife, her sexuality is there and she gets horny and she masturbates and she has sex with the occasional person, when we have Jodie, which it would be so easy to make fun of this girl, the book is really respectful to her. And the midwife, as frustrating as she can be sometimes, because Jodie is a little childlike in some ways, so she does get frustrated with her occasionally, but it's not because she's a virgin. It's not because she wants to be monogamous with Honest.
She lives in a closet in society.
But, you know, that is not made fun of.
Yeah, no,
like her choice to do – I mean, there's that really sort of touching, awkward conversation she has with Honest about Jodie, who doesn't really want to have sex and maybe doesn't even masturbate, and Honest is not sure how to – please her and what to do. And there's that, it's this awkward birds and the bees kind of conversation that they have, but at no time, the midwife never thinks ill of them.
Yes.
Never thinks they're stupid or
you're right. It's what's fantastic.
You know, I think that the book is really, it's very careful about not judging the human need for intimacy in any of its forms, the lack of
I
need
think
for
it's
intimacy.
That respect, that respectful nature that made me think it was a less angry book than. Yeah. You know, you're right. It is obviously.
But you can be angry and respectful.
No, I know.
At the same time.
Well, actually, that's a unique thing in the world.
It's rare.
Point to me,
rare.
Angry and respectful people. You know, that feels mutually exclusive these days. But
well, they're the ones that people don't notice so much because they're being respectful while being angry.
I know. Anyway, look, we should wrap this up because I think we've been speaking for about 3 hours. But
I did just want to say, I don't want to end on a down note, but.
Well, we started on a down note. Let's end there.
I think this is a really good book, and obviously I really enjoyed it. But I'm really interested to see what Ellison does in the rest of her career, because I think there's a few things that mark this out as quite an early book. And one of them was, as much as I liked that mix of third-person narration and omniscient narrator versus journal entries and the framing device and all of that, and I thought that worked mostly pretty well, I think there was a somewhat incessant tying of loose ends that just, I think, undercut what the book was doing to some extent. And the two really major parts were, you get this chapter about Roxanne, and I can't remember the name of the man that she goes off with on the bicycle. And the book says, their story was never written down. And I don't have a problem with that, because there's all this omniscient stuff that can't have been written down. It's the book telling you the story of the world. But I don't like that loose end was tied up.
I understand.
And especially Roxanne's life did not end well. And you kind of knew it wouldn't end well when she ran off. But our midwife doesn't know that. And I don't think we should get to know that. And in the same way that we get Jake, who was her Jake,
her boyfriend,
and he's gone when she wakes up at the beginning of the book, and she doesn't know where he is, and she finds out at the very, very end when she gets to Fort Nowhere what happened to him. But we, the reader, get a chapter in the middle of the book about what happened to him.
Yep.
So for the rest of that book, when she mentions him, and she does frequently mention him. In fact, there's a line where she's talking about she's decided to leave Honest and Jodie and just leave them to their house, and she doesn't want to be a part of this emotional triumphant anymore, and she's going to go. And she's tossing up whether she should just leave in the middle of the night. She says, no, 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 I don't want to be a mystery to them like Jack is a mystery to me.
Yep.
And so, and he is at that point for her, but he's not to us. We know what happened to him. We know he committed suicide. And I felt resentful of that knowledge.
Oh, that's
because we're so aligned with her through emotionally through so much of the book. I thought it was not.
I just thought it was part of the interesting structure of the novel.
It was not fair of the author to give me that. I didn't want that knowledge. All of the other knowledge we kind of get is not about people that impinge on the midwife.
You know, I understand.
It's like, here's what's happened over here, here's what's happened over here. But it's not tying up the loose ends of stories of people who came into her orbit. And I really would have preferred it if they were left. Like, when she gets to Fort Nowhere and the thing about Jake that she finds, that's fine. Closure for her and she moves on. But I would have rather we'd found that out at the same time.
Yep, gotcha.
I didn't want that knowledge. I only wanted to know what she knew about the people. And I knew Roxanne would end up at a bad end. I knew that. I don't need to be told it anyway, any more than the midwife needed to know, which she never does.
Yeah, understood.
I like the idea that I could still think, as she can still think, that Roxanne's maybe out there somewhere doing stuff. And it just felt – and there was also the Honus and Jody bit that was done too, which didn't – The what was in there, the content of it, didn't bother me so much because it wasn't, didn't really impinge on the midwife either way. But
do you think that's first novelitis?
I just don't think – I think that those tying up of loose ends, if this is a book about,
I think it ties into the religious tone of the novel.
But
because the Bible does that too.
Yeah, but everything that's in the book – like the overview omniscient stuff,
I hear what you're saying. I just think for me it didn't bother me because it tied into that Ford sort of gospel biblical feel of the novel that the novel has.
Like I said, the omniscient stuff I didn't care about. It's just those two specific parts.
But including tying threads up.
Yeah, but what that did for me was remove me from the midwife's side. It put me in the room with the scribes. It put me outside the book.
Okay.
And I was no longer her equal in terms of how she lived in the world, what she knew, what she hoped, what she feared.
Okay.
Because I knew stuff she didn't. And I didn't want to be
I'd
in
argue
position.
you know stuff from the very beginning that she doesn't.
Not
that
about
is, so that her papers survive.
Not me. About her actual day-to-day life.
Okay.
I didn't know that. I didn't want to know about Jake.
You have
I didn't
to bring
want
this
to know
up
about
now. We've spoken about the book for 40 odd minutes and now you bring it up. I mean, I feel like I want to
But that's what I'm saying. It's like I did want to bring that up because I resented the tying up of loose ends,
as a result, you'll never read anything by me.
I actually really do want to read. Like if she writes more books, and I hope she does, I would really want to read them because I think this book is so strong and so remarkable in so many ways that what I see as missteps, I think is a beginning writer.
See, I don't have the same view, but that's okay. That's okay. I'm right, you're wrong, and just the usual. I hear what you're saying. For me, it felt natural within the novel. I mean,
it did, but
I'll be honest. Yeah. I've skimmed it recently, but I read it first in January, so it doesn't have the same immediacy as it does for you.
Because it was so immersive. You were right there with the midwife. You were right there all the time, and as soon as you got these bits. That privileged your knowledge about her life. That's what it was. It was your knowledge about her life and the people she knew. And you shouldn't have that privilege above her because you're beside her.
It's a fair point.
So that was the thing I kind of like.
Don't you hate when I say it? That's so patronizing. It's a fair it's a fair point.
I know
to be quiet.
It's a fair point because it's how I felt. but basically I think it was an awesome book about the angel of contraception, as she calls herself.
I highly, highly recommend you read this award-winning novel.
Yeah, and it's a really readable book.
I think if you want fantasy, please read The Godless by Ben Peake, my reservations aside, and Kirsten's I Hate All Fantasy Novel reservations aside.
I did not say that.
Said something similar to that. And I think if you want a post-apocalyptic novel that
I think one that actually tackles
which is why I quoted Matthew Chaney's take on post-apocalyptic stuff at the start of my review, which is that, and I'm not even looking at it now, I should be, but too many post-apocalyptic novels don't take seriously what a post-apocalyptic thing would be. Mm. That it's going to be fucking hard. It's, you know, it's all going to be bloody rose bushes and
which was my issue sunshine. With Station 11.
Yeah, I know. Which is, and he was writing it in context of Station 11.
Oh, was anyway, he? Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I would agree with him then.
You feel free to make a link to his thoughts on the.
Okay, thing. I will.
Because it's in my review.
Dig that out of your review.
Yeah. All right. So
I think we're done. We're done with the books. Done. I think two good books, though.
Yes.
Two good books.
Yes.
With different levels of engagement for Kirsten. Because one was very mimetic. Like, but that's the thing, right? The Book of the Unnamed Midwife, right down the mimetic end of the scale. A little bit of the mythic with the post-apocalyptic thing.
I am fascinated to see how you react to the book I'm going to recommend.
And the Ben Peake one, right at the mythic end.
Fascinated to see how you you react to this book.
Okay, where does it sit?
Interesting. It's not a I don't want to prejudice you, but my book, I reviewed it, so don't read my review.
I never read them until after I...
Yeah, in other words, you never look at my blog. No. That's what you're trying to tell me.
No, only after.
Yeah, whatever. My book is Viper Wine by Hermione Eyre. It's E-Y-R-E, so I'm assuming it's Eyre, like Jane Eyre. So
Hermione Eyre.
Yeah, Hermione Eyre. Viper Wine is my book.
Excellent. I will grab that.
And yours?
Mine is another Australian novel. I'm being very good. it's Day Boy by Trent Jamison.
Okay.
So it only came out, I think, in like the beginning of August or end of July. So it's a fairly newish book. But by the time we review it, that's October. So you guys will all have had a chance to read it and it won't get spoiled.
So, oh, wait, when did it come out?
Pretty recently. It's like, I think July, okay, maybe.
Cool.
So it's, fairly new, quite a good book. I think we'll have an interesting talk about it.
Okay, so that's Day Boy. And Viper Wine, I should say, was nominated for and won The Kitschies. One of the Kitschies, the debut novel Kitschy bit.
Cool.
Not the non-debut
novel. Actual debut novel?
Yes. Okay. I think so. She's a journalist, I believe. Anyway, well, look, we can talk about that when we get to it.
Excellent.
In about, when is October sometime?
October-ish.
Yeah. Before your birthday?
Definitely before my birthday. Definitely in the first half of the month.
Well, are you going to Mongolia again?
No, my mum's coming down to stay.
Ah, similar to going to Mongolia.
So I'm not doing podcast shit while my mum's down.
Okay. Please send feedback to, that was all very important stuff to know. Please send feedback to the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can email us, writerandcritic@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, which a number of you are. I keep seeing people following us, which is lovely. Writer and Critic. And iTunes. 5 stars, but I don't think, no longer forcing people.
forcing.
Yeah, compelling people to do that. It's been fantastic, Kirsten.
It has.
We should do this more regularly.
Maybe next year.
Do you promise?
No.
Okay. So for me, that's good night. That's how long we've been talking for. We started this at 3 in the – we started, 8 in the morning? It's midnight.
Oh, funny.
Yes, and for you, it's also good night.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. I need to go to the toilet.